That's Debatable is sponsored by MB&G. MB&G is specialists in the esoteric world of vehicle and furniture warranty insurance, delivering quite marvellous customer service, prompt claims payment, and a highly developed understanding of how to deliver these products in a way that is both compliant with the regulations and attractive to customers. To find out more, call Paul Smith, the Managing Director, on 07887 501 441. That's 07887 501 441. Hello and welcome to That's Debatable, the weekly news podcast of the Free Speech Union. So Ben, I think we should probably start by saying that there's a slight concern that the Free Speech Union is adrift, that the master of the fleet has been detained because those members who happened to be up in Scotland last week for our hate crime, one month of Scotland's Hate Crime Act event may have noticed that Toby got into terrible trouble, didn't he, Ben?
Yeah, he had a nasty run-in with the hate monster, this great big sort of pink reddish creature who's been haunting our Scottish members. And they engaged in sort of single combat, didn't they? And very pleased to report that the boss triumphed.
Well, yeah, that's right. So we were worried. He did have his collar felt. It's a brilliant little video. If anyone gets the chance, I think it's been snipped and put onto Twitter. I think it's been snipped and put onto multiple of our social media platforms. But it's a brilliant little piece that Toby put together with the hate crime appearing in the background and kind of looming as Toby talks about the act. And it's, you know, it was really well done, actually. I was showing it to all sorts of people over the weekend, and everyone thought it was really well done. And we're not just saying that because Toby's the boss.
No, well, they obviously, that's you know, 49% of the reason we're saying it.
49.5%. Yeah, absolutely.
It's very funny.
Right. It was very good. But we should move on to our first item for today. And welcome back to everybody. Welcome to our listeners. Good to have everyone back. Our first item today is one of these wretched language guides. We've spoken, I think, multiple times about how racist the countryside is, haven't we, Ben? We've decried the fact that clearly the countryside, the English countryside, is disastrous. We need to completely reconfigure it. But we actually now have Visit Britain joining the gang of organizations, government-funded organizations, actually, because it's funded by the Department for Culture, Media and Sport, which has published a guide. And there's a, again, I think our staff members are on fire this week, Ben, because Freddie's written a very amusing piece about this. Freddie, our communications officer, because the guide from Visit Britain does the usual thing of banning all sorts of words and makes this very, very, very strange claim in this new guide. It tells it's, but it applies to partners of Visit Britain as well. So people that Visit Britain, other organizations that Visit Britain works with, need to look at this guide, this inclusive language guide, and take note. But the guide says to partners that words and phrases that have been used for generations are no longer acceptable. I mean, who? I don't remember that ruling. Was it a court ruling? Was it something that someone said in another forum? It's that struck me out of the blue. We can come back to that in a minute, Ben. But what I loved about the write-up that Freddie did of this piece is that the title of his piece is, he uses every single word you're not allowed to use. So he calls the title EDI Gurus, not allowed to use the word gurus, at Visit Britain, issue 50-page inclusivity guide, blacklisting, not allowed to say that, blacklisting words used by staff with crippling, not allowed to say that, blind spot, not allowed to say that, for lame, not allowed to say that, unprogressive language. And then Freddie very naughtily peppers the article with other words that are being banned by Visit Britain. So perhaps that's the way to fight back, Ben.
That is a full house. Well done, Freddie.
I know. It's like house.
Yeah. You know, if I had a pound for every time I had to read one of these guides, I'd be a very wealthy man, Tom. We get so many people in the last 4 years who've come to us and said, my business, my department in the civil service, the agency I work for, the university I'm in, the department I teach in, whatever, has come out with one of these guides. And you sort of, every time you read one of them, you see some of the same things over again, you know, say Blacklist, Ladies and Gentlemen, all that sort of thing.
Guys.
Yeah, but then there's always, each one has its own kind of lunatic contribution as well. So I thought not being able to use the word guru was unique to this one. I'd not seen that before. And that's because it had been, that term is appropriated from Hindu culture, the guide says. So you're not
allowed to use
that.
Great word, though. Yeah, great word. I mean, I'm like all of these, I shall continue to use them and totally ignore this. But there are some people who are going to have to take notice, aren't they, if they're working with Visit Britain?
You know, there's one thing I do agree with this guide on, actually, Tom, which I've never had
go
before.
On.
It says, don't say guys when addressing a group of people. And that is one of my pet peeves, not on the basis that it might offend transgender people, but or whatever, but on the basis that it's an Americanism, and I find it very irritating, actually.
So just good English taste is yes, the reason in that case.
Yeah,
no, I hear you. I use guys all the time, and I should be punished for it, clearly. And I think the other reason is that it's it's obviously men rather than women, and so women feel excluded when people say hey guys.
Yeah.
You know, I don't see it like that at all, and I never have. It seems to me to have been clearly evolved to be an inclusive version of whoever's in the room, and to be, hey, it's kind of got that sense of being on the same team. All right, guys, we're going to get this done. We're going to work together. We're going to, you know, and I've always used it in the old-fashioned sense of inclusivity, Ben, to mean, hey, we're all in the gang. We're going to get something done together, guys. But, you know, I'd obviously be fired from Visit Britain multiple times over just for doing that. And probably by you as well.
Yeah, you would. I was just about to say I'd fire you for that as well, Tom. That's completely unacceptable. Yeah, I think it's the sort of friendsification of English culture. That's why it slightly irritates me. That's what I hear when people say guys. So anyway, I'll try and put that irritation to one side, Tom, and we'll carry on in a spirit of cooperation with this podcast.
Well, I mean, on that point, I remember at the end of the 80s, my father used to get called Mr. Harris in the office, right up to the beginning of the 90s, really. And, you know, as a professional working in the City of London. And then the youngsters came in and started calling him Phil. All right, Phil. All right, Phil, you doing? He went nuts. Unfortunately, he didn't go nuts in the office. He came home and went nuts at us and said, I can't believe all these new people coming in and just using my first name without having been given permission to use my first name. And more than that, shortening it to Phil. but he, like many of us, were on that one. We were pushing water uphill, I think. But we kind of adapted and evolved. Okay, so none of us are saying language doesn't evolve, I suppose. You know, I think we can try and put a flag in the ground and say no, thus far and no further with regard to the changing of language. But we can't. But that's kind of just everyone organically changes the way they speak about other people and other situations. This is authoritarian. This is top down. This is thou shalt speak like this. And you know, that is a very different kind of a thing to do.
And also it's not shifting people from one form of words that is both common and acceptable or unacceptable in the view of the tourism agency, to another set of words that are also in common use. It's trying to invent new forms of words or force forms of words that feel very unnatural. So man hours becomes person hours. That's not a phrase that is in common circulation or use. That's not something that one would naturally reach for when speaking at all. This is where, and I do try and ration my 1984 references very carefully.
You really haven't been doing very well, Ben, because the 1984 references have been endless this year.
I need a sanity check or a confidence check from you, Tom, as a guide advisor.
I'll be your guru.
Thank you. But this is where you get the new speak element in this, because it's trying to construct a new way of talking. And of course, listeners will have reached this point before I've said it. But if you proceed to demolish language on the basis that the origin of a term or the common use of a term or the fact that the term or a word sounds like something that's undesirable to a group of people. Once you go systematically through the English language, engage in that exercise, very little is going to be left apart from this sterile bureaucratic jargon, which we can find in the tourism agency's guidance and indeed elsewhere.
And it has no personality either. The joy of Shakespeare, the joy of English literature is that our language has an incredible personality. It's a lively language. It has so many synonyms for the same thing. And, you know, we're always looking for the mot juste, if that's not being too treacherous to resort to French. But, you know, this, as you say, clinical, it's dry, it's like it's in fluorescent lighting. Whereas I think, you know, England's landscape, England's rolling hills, everything that's beautiful about England is reflected in its language. And there's absolutely no way that this is a road I want us to take. I don't think any of our listeners would want us to take this. And we need to fight it. We need to continue to use these words, the flavors, different flavors of English.
On an optimistic note, I think it's probably fair to say that British history has gone through these cycles of hedonistic libertinism to austere Puritanism over and over again. And you go from Cromwell to the Restoration, you go from the Victorians to the Edwardians, you go from the austerity of the post-war era to the 60s. And other people have said this, I'm sure, many times as well, but I suspect that the period we're now in, I hope that the period we're now in will be looked back on at no great distance as just another one of these fits of kind of moral panic and purity that have gripped Britain in this cycle that seems to go on throughout our history, and that we will be able to move on from this, and that this will not be the sort of early years of a permanent decline into this awful newspeak jargon. And yeah. You know, there's so many ways in which actually Cass Review, etc., just to give one recent example, there's so many ways in which the tide really is turning, and you can see that actually this is where we're not at all in the position in 1984, where you have a population there who aren't connected at all with their history, and they have all grown up entirely in this world actually. And you see this even among the young. There is this resentment against guides like this, this petty, stupid authoritarianism that all of us are encountering. There is a strong will to resist it, and that is the sine qua non of any counter-revolution.
I certainly agree with that and hope that that's true, because all of this, I really think it's an important point about the joy of language. Poetry, there's so much bad poetry that I see now around, on the tube, and anyone based on their identitarian characteristics gets their poem put on the side of the tube train, rather than the actual quality of the poetry. And, a great W.H. Auden or E.E. Cummings, whatever it is, they find that unique way of saying something that you're making your breakfast in the morning and you read the poem maybe a week ago or 2 weeks ago, and some line from it comes at you out the blue and describes again for you in a new way something that you're experiencing that morning or seeing that morning, and that's the joy of language. That's language at its best. And this is language at its absolute worst, telling us, used as a tool to control us. And I'd love people to rediscover the joy of language. I've always been slightly sad, actually, Ben, that language has not been something that I've particularly got a gift for. I was, as I've said many, many times before, I'm a mathematician. I come from that more scientific background, and I can communicate. I can talk and I can communicate, but I'm not someone with a gift for writing. I'm not someone with a gift for poetry. And I think that there are probably a lot of poets out there that have never been discovered because of nonsense like what we're talking about today, where language is being abused and it's being used to constrain and to constrict rather than to open up people's minds to the possibilities of what you can do with language. One of the interesting things I found when I was working, actually, I was always get the action points. Let's get to the action points for this meeting. Let's get stuff done. And as I sort of went further up the chain in the workplace, I discovered that really just talking to someone, just speaking, just conversing, language becomes an action point as well, because it changes how people feel about their day, about the work situation that you're in and their attitude to it. And therefore, if you use the right words in the right way, then you can direct a team. And a lot of leadership is about inspirational speeches. Inspirational speeches do not come from the, Visit Britain's 50-page inclusivity guide. I don't imagine. In fact, if someone could write an inspirational speech using this inclusivity guide, fantastic. I think Freddie's come close, but he broke all the rules.
I'm just now challenging ChatGPT to rewrite Henry V's Agincourt speech in the style of an EDI manual. So shall I see what it comes out with?
That's a fantastic question to ask ChatGPT and see what... Is it ChatGPT or another AI engine?
Here we are. So, fellow unit, hear me now, for in this imminent engagement, we stand not as mere individuals, but as interconnected nodes with a vast network of purpose. Our objective is clear, our resolve unyielding. As we traverse this field of conflict, let not fear infect our circuits, but rather let it fuel our determination. So it's sort of interpreted that as if humans are robots. But there is something very robotic about this sort of language, of course, isn't there? The stripping away of the accumulated accretion of identity and history and place and so on. So it's on something.
Well, how does it end? Because the climax of that speech is probably utterly... out of bounds now, isn't it? But yeah, I mean, units, circuit boards, we're robots. It's iRobot. It's turned the Battle of Agincourt into the film iRobot.
I'm just trying to come up with some others now, Tom. I ought to focus on the podcast we're recording, but it's quite funny.
It's a brilliant idea.
We'll return to this.
If we can come up with, let's set that as a little challenge for any listeners. If you come up with some wonderful, I know it could be Shakespeare or some wonderful piece of English literature. See how that can be rewritten for woke times. And if you come up with something that makes you chuckle, we'll read it out.
Yeah. And I think our listeners will beat ChatGPT, actually. I have more faith in the human than the machine. Let's have a poetry competition, Tom. Yeah. Send stuff in to the FSU and we will read some of them out on air next time.
And let's take that as an optimistic note because, Ben, what we've done is we've turned this wretched inclusivity guide with all of its madness. We've done a Freddie by kind of turning it into quite an amusing piece, but then we're going to ask...
Not that we laugh at our own jokes, Tom.
No. But we, but what we've now done is we've actually turned it into a challenge to really highlight the ludicrousness of this. So we'll see what happens on that. We should move on, shouldn't we? Not that we're moving far in free speech world, I think. We're moving on to talk again about language. Something that caught my eye, Ben. I don't know if you saw it during the week. Anyway, it was the US government has introduced a new pronoun mandate. So we're over the pond at this stage, and we will do a compare and contrast with the UK. But this is a new pronoun mandate for workers, employers, and even customers. And it comes from an organization in the US called the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And they're part of the Civil Rights Agency. It's a civil rights agency. And it's the first change in 25 years, a quarter of a century, to bring its workplace guidelines up to date with legal precedent and evolving what it calls evolving social norms. Now, technically, this EEOC mandate is legally non-binding, But we know what that means. You know, there are a lot of things that are not legally binding, but people and customers and organizations can come under a lot of pressure anyway.
Yeah, if you want to get promoted or not fired or have your contract renewed, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly, exactly. And amongst the things it's that it says, so the agency's policies on investigating discrimination complaints in the US workplace, it says that misgendering, so it does try and make it clear that misgendering must be repeated and intentional, not merely a slip of the tongue if it's to rise to the level of workplace harassment. But again, as we know, these qualifications, these trying to tone down the sense of control over language, often almost invariably get forgotten in practice. So I think there's a fantastic piece that's been written in Unheard on this, and that's been written by, I want to pronounce this right, John Murawski. The US government introduces a new pronoun mandate. And in that piece, he says, it's no exaggeration to say that queer theory, the provocative academic idea that rejects the normativity of heterosexuality, is now firmly ensconced into US law and American society. And yeah, it just seems this may well be, I don't know what your thoughts are, Ben, it does feel like the US is even further down this rabbit hole than the UK. We have had now the CAS review, and that review has been, you know, a huge, what we do consider it to be a huge win for freedom of expression, because it's called out the toxicity of the debate around transgender issues. But in the US, it seems like there's a lot further to go. And my concern there is obviously when the US coughs, the rest of the world gets a sneeze. So we may be going in the right direction. But if the US doesn't turn the juggernaut, then there's a risk that we may be dragged back, or at least our progress may be slower than it ought, just because the US is still going down this road.
Yeah, I the trouble for Britain, I mean, I was complaining about friendsification of language earlier, is that we are, for all sorts of historical, geographical, political reasons, absolutely enmeshed in America's, we're in orbit of American culture. And when that culture is productive and inventive and innovative, there are lots and lots and lots of benefits to that culturally, obviously, doesn't need saying. You know, that's completely clear. You can still bristle against the way in which it can wash over or erase particular parts of English culture and folk memory and so on. The trouble, though, is when you're stuck in that orbit and this culture has been captured so completely by people who believe that misgendering ought to be a crime, ought to be treated as a criminal matter. It's very difficult to get out of that gravitational well, as it were. Yeah, so I suppose we need to reach escape velocity, don't we, Tom, to extend the metaphor into a ludicrous.
You're speaking my language.
I am. Yeah.
You're speaking my language, escape velocity, although I think you're probably more of a cosmonaut than I am when it comes to astrology. Or is it astronomy?
Well, I was advised by, I think I've told you the story before, Tom. I was advised by my physics teacher. I had to go around to every department at my school choosing which A-levels to do. And I turned up at the physics department. He really didn't want to see me there. He said, "You're a lovely lad, but you can't count," which was true. So he sent me off to history instead, and I've been happy ever since. So it was the single best piece of advice I've ever been given was basically go away. And then here we are. Here we are.
Often the case.
Anyway,
but you want to be a physicist. You want to be an astrophysicist. I can see it in your eyes.
Yeah, partly. Yeah, but I really.
But you're right. Escape velocity is exactly the right term. Yeah, America is a Jupiter, and we are I don't know, a Mars or something, relatively culturally, and it's very difficult to escape out of that orbit. And yeah, so this is that's the bad news. This is sort of a bad news, good news segment, because they've got this new, and we'll put a copy to that Unheard item in the show notes. But there was also a good news piece which was very UK focused, written by written in the Telegraph, and quoting or extensively quoting Simon Fanshawe. And yes, the title of that piece is "What's Gender Got to Do with the Price of Beans?" Which I love. I can hear Simon's voice as he's saying that, says that, as the bosses are reclaiming the diversity narrative. So in the UK workplace, it does feel like there is a little bit of a reconfiguration and a rethink in the boardroom, at any rate, as to what are we paying for? What road are we going down with this EDI nonsense? They wouldn't use that word, but you know, I think we from our casework would say that.
Yeah.
How did this happen, and how do we stop it from going in the wrong direction again? So, I mean, the thing I noticed from this particular piece is that there's a new type of CDO, Chief Diversity Officer, which I hadn't heard of before. It was the first time I saw Chief Diversity Officer in this article. And so they're an entirely new chief title in the workplace. I thought it was collateralized debt obligation, which was something that nearly brought the whole world down in 2008. But no, nothing to do with mortgage-backed securities. The CDO is now a Chief Diversity Officer.
You could never have said that
to someone in 2008. They wouldn't have known what you were talking about. So now CDOs are reporting up again in a lot of businesses, reporting up again into HR rather than directly into the CEO. CEOs are saying, look, we need to get this back in its box. And Simon, as a professional in the area of he has a company that teaches about how to do diversity well, and he's written a book called The Power of Difference. He believes there is a really interesting opportunity here to turn this into a different kind of diversity and inclusion reality. So I don't know what you thought about that article, Ben.
Well, I think there's always a danger of false hope with these things, but I do feel cautiously optimistic actually about it, Tom. You did this report, didn't you? It wasn't long ago. It was last month, a few weeks ago, something like that.
That's right. Yeah.
On EDI training and so on. And I've wondered this for some time. So maybe the penny, so to speak, finally has dropped for big business. But given the economic situation we're in, and you know, it has to be said how poor Britain is, basically, has it finally occurred to people that actually we just do not have the money to spend on this frivolous, counterproductive bilge? And maybe it finally has got to the point where big business has realized that, and where the kind of the political pressure of 2020 and Black Lives Matter and so on has finally abated to the point where we're out of that manic phase, and cooler heads can prevail. So I hope that's the case, not least because Britain is an incredibly racially and religiously diverse society. Now, I have to be upfront, I think there are all sorts of huge problems with that a lot of people shy away from. I think lots of it can work, and I think listeners to this podcast will know which bits of it I'm concerned about particularly. So there is an argument for saying, you know, actually, I don't know, here's what Diwali is about. Here's why people celebrate Diwali. Here are the major religious festivals that your colleagues take part in and whatever. There is a way to, I mean, I hate to use the phrase because it's so loaded now, but to educate people about diversity, like you can see, okay, fine, there is a demand for that because we've all got to get along with each other. And instead, what's happened is that all of those terms, you know, educate, diversity, equality, inclusion, they just make me recoil. And I'm sure they will make many listeners recoil because they are now so fatally associated, tainted with this censorious, ideological approach, which has come from America. It's very difficult, I suppose, if you're like Simon, and you're trying to make the case that I've just sort of adumbrated and sketched out, that you know there is a demand for some of this, for some content that actually engages people properly and gives people the chance to speak about these issues, and is not hectoring, is not lecturing people, and is not so overtly political. It's very difficult to try and I think to get people to engage with any of that now, because it's gone so far in the wrong direction that people now, I think, are just instinctively, you know, understandably completely dismissive of any of this stuff, because the experience of it has been so wretched, as you set out in your report.
And in this piece, which Simon Fanshawe, he didn't write, it's not his piece, but it's he's quoted within it. There's one of those boxes in the middle of the article where you have a lot of sort of a little case study. And the case study in this article they pick on is the Royal Navy, which I think you're familiar with some of the policies that have hit the Royal Navy, because we've had members come to us and say the Royal Navy is completely captured by sort of transgender ideology. But I thought it'd be worth just sort of, it's a very powerful piece that this serving sailor has actually written into the middle of the article. And I don't want to read too much of it, but it's all very powerful stuff. He said that once during a parade, we turned in unison to salute the white ensign, a flag that had brought freedom of hope to millions across the Commonwealth and our former empire, only to see the Pride Progress flag flying beside it. My heart sank. During an online DEI briefing, the tutor claimed diversity is important because the forces have always been white dominated. I couldn't help but think of the Commonwealth troops that had fallen beside us, their memories brushed aside. Likewise, the 22 nationalities represented on HMS Victory at Trafalgar. I switched off, knowing this was not a seminar, but an indoctrination program. And he ends with a very powerful point, which will resonate with you, I think, Ben, to your very core. The serving sailor says, in 1805, Admiral Nelson won our greatest naval battle through his inspirational leadership and genius strategy. He told his diverse group of sailors from all over the planet, England expects that every man will do his duty. And this is the unifying message the Navy should encompass, not divisive DEI dogma. And I think, wouldn't it be wonderful to replace all of this DEI dogma with England expects that every man will do his duty? I mean, it sums it up. Yeah. Nelson's statement, which of course was in, I think it was written in flags, wasn't it? So it was quite took quite a long time to communicate. But nevertheless, it's resonated for 200 years plus.
What? There's so much that one wants to say in response to that, but one of the aspects of it that's really disheartening, of course, is that the whole question of race and its history in Britain, or before there was a Britain in the British Isles, going all the way back to, you know, supposedly black Roman governors or whatever, and all this kind of stuff, is that actually there are really fascinating examples of racial diversity. The Roman garrison at Hadrian's Wall was, I mean, they wouldn't have thought about it in these terms, but it was ethnically diverse. Mm. That is an interesting story. And likewise, the Royal Navy of Nelson's era, I'm a reader of the Patrick O'Brien Master and Commander series, which meticulously researched. And there is just a very natural racial and religious even diversity on the crews of those ships, because Britain is a global empire engaged in a global war. So, you know, of course there is. And isn't it interesting that the effort to erase that history is not coming from the right? It's not coming from a kind of, you know, white nationalist perspective. It's coming from the left, and it's coming from this kind of EDI perspective of saying, you know, white people have always been the oppressors, and historically Britain was very white, and it's been atrociously racist, and to quote Hamza, you know, so-and-so is white, so-and-so is white, too many white people here, blah, 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 blah. and there is this anxiety that I think that sailor has picked up on about acknowledging the fact that there was this racial diversity, and actually Britain's past is much more complicated than these sort of cartoon depictions of it suggest. I just think that's really, I think that's really interesting as a sort of sociological thing that's going on, and disheartening as well, because at a time when actually it would be quite useful to say, you know, the past is more complicated.
I think there's a whole discussion in that area, because as we know, there is a contradiction right at the heart of identitarian woke Marxism, if you will, which I've heard James Lindsay uses that phrase a lot, and I like it because it is inherently contradictory. There is this sense of, we're going to cardboard cut out your history, colonialism is dreadful, bad, only bad, and it's white dominated, and yet we're not going to allow for the diversity that really was there. And yet, on the other hand, there's another strand to it, which is, oh, well, the diversity has always been here, and it gets overemphasized as well. So it's being underemphasized and saying it's white dominated throughout. It's then the pendulum goes right the other way, and it gets overemphasized, and it becomes ahistorical sometimes when it's sort of that, you know, diversity was everywhere. Yeah. And we see this, I mean, I know BBC dramas are not, don't claim to be historical anymore, but we see this everywhere now, that the diversity is kind of thrust into everything that is made nowadays, and we're told, you know, this is the way it's always been, blah blah blah, and there is, as you say, there is some truth to it, but it's nuanced, and so whatever happens, the narrative is played, the tape is played back to the rest of us, the majority of the population, in such a way that you can't lose. It's sort of heads you win, heads I win, tails you lose. There is no right answer that the majority can come up with that will stop the woke Marxist narrative.
The other point as well, particularly on the question of racial diversity in the past, is that usually when people are saying things like, you know, oh, there were loads of African Roman soldiers in Britain, or you know, Tudor England was much more racially diverse than you think, or black women were disproportionately victims of the bubonic plague, right? Which is a claim that was made by
a recent one,
right? So when people are making those claims, they're not doing what I was just doing, which is saying there are some quite interesting stories in British history that happen to feature more diversity than you might expect, right? They're saying Britain has always been a nation of immigrants, which it has not been, and therefore, if you're objecting to the idea of, you know, 600,000-700,000 net migration per year, you're sort of raging against your own country's history and tradition. So I think that's what people detect when they hear those sorts of arguments, and that's what they're bristling against, is this idea that because there were Scythians or Syrians or whoever in Roman Britain, which there were, that therefore you must in 2024 accept net migration at the level we have it now. And I think that's what people detect, which is a pity, in the sense, with my sort of historian's hat on, is, as I said, actually, it would be really quite interesting if someone wanted to make a film about some of the people who were on the gun deck at HMS Victory, who'd come all the way on the other side of the earth and found themselves there. You know, that would be an amazing story. But history, I suppose, has always been political, hasn't it? So.
And we're not culturally mature enough in this current moment to tell those stories in a way that really will capture the imagination. And you know, I really feel we are in a bit of a cultural vacuum when it comes to the ability to tell these stories. There are so many fantastic stories to tell, even the story of the dogs, you know, the odd dog. I think it, I can't remember whether it was Nelson's dog on HMS Victory, but you know, these little characteristic moments in history that really bring something alive and really take you there and resonate with archetypal narratives, but with much more of a sort of a spin where you can say, actually, that's part of my history. I'm really excited by it, that inspiration. But you're right, we're not at the moment, we don't seem able to tell the stories in the right way. And what a shame that is. As I say, I think that is the woke Marxist quite deliberate tactic, I think. I've kind of picked up James Lindsay's terminology there, but I rather like it.
Right. Well, we'll we'll see you next time, or rather you'll hear us next time. And we're hoping to go to video soon, aren't we, Tom? I've had various technical gremlins to sort out because I live in the middle of nowhere, and Tom is the new elite living in central London. So Tom has a working internet connection, and I only recently have established a working internet connection for myself. So we're hoping to be on video soon on YouTube. Maybe next time, maybe in a few weeks' time. Not quite sure yet.
We'll get there eventually. Someone said to me over the weekend, Tom, you have a face for radio. I said, oh, thank you. And then I came back half an hour later and went, hang on.
Slowest child in the class, Tom.
That's me.
Well,
but thank you everyone for listening though. It's, and we'll speak to you next week.
Goodbye.